We've been working through a series of lessons called Experience the Journey. And it has to do with how do we live together as brothers and sisters in Christ. And I chose the book of 1 Corinthians to work through because we know more about the church at Corinth than any other church of the New Testament. More than the church at Jerusalem, more than the church at Antioch. We know about the church at Corinth. And of course, people who have looked at the church at Corinth in the past have said, wow, what a messed up church. And you know what? It was. And so are we. I think the reason that God gave us such an insight in the church at Corinth is that he wanted to say, listen, this is what my people look like. Yes, we're sinners, but sinners who have been redeemed, who are on a journey back to God, and we bring with it all of our brokenness and all of our struggles, and that manifests itself in the life of the church. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, going through chapter 14, Paul is dealing with this issue of how do we behave in relationship to one another when we come together as Christians. He talks about clothing, in particular about veils, who should wear them, who should not. It's very strange to us because we don't live in a world where one or the other of the sexes veils itself. He goes on to talk about the Lord's Supper and how that he could not commend them because they were really abusing it. I mean, they were going way outside the boundaries of what we should be doing when it comes to gathering around the Lord's table. And then last week, we looked at 1 Corinthians chapter 12, spiritual giftedness. And Paul had gifted so many of the Corinthians with all kinds of gifts. I mean, the ability to prophesy, knowledge, wisdom. He'd given some the ability to heal, to perform miracles, to speak in languages they had not studied, to interpret languages they had never studied. I mean, all kinds of special gifts that were necessary as the early church was launching out into the world. The Corinthians, like most other things, had abused these spiritual gifts. Especially those who could speak in tongues. They were quite proud of it. And they were using the tongues, which we'll learn next week, was meant for unbelievers. They were using the tongues in order to kind of have this special relationship with God. You know, I can pray in tongues. I can speak in tongues. Look what I can do. And you had the Apostle Paul says, listen, it's not about you. It's about the church. It's about the kingdom of God. And so right in the middle of his discussion on spiritual gifts, he pauses. And notice what he says when he starts this chapter. He says, now about these spiritual gifts, these gifts of the Spirit, this working of the Spirit in the life of the church, I don't want you to be uninformed. He then talks about it. He gets to the end of the chapter, and he says, and yet I will show you the most excellent way. I love the way he phrases this. He uses the Greek word, hyperbole. The word hooper there, we should be familiar with. We get our word hyper from it. And if you've ever been around grandchildren, June and I have three grandkids. One of them's not hyper yet. He's only 4 months old. But the other two are about 2 to almost 3. And let me tell you, they are hyper. I mean, one of them came to see me yesterday. I was laying on the couch watching a football game. He walks in and says, ride in Pop's truck. And I'm like, yeah, we will in a minute. He said, put shoes on, Pops. And I'm like, okay. And then we got back from riding in the truck, and he says, ride on Pops' lawnmower. And I'm like, sure, let's ride on the lawnmower. Finally, after about 30, 45 minutes, I went in and looked at June and said, he's yours. I mean, good night. Hyper is this sense of going way beyond what you normally see. And he's saying here, he says, listen, there's a way of living life that is so beyond these spiritual gifts that you're focusing on. And so in chapter 13, the great love chapter of 1 Corinthians, of the Bible, he launches into that. And the point you need to understand is this. He's going to talk about the fact that, listen, spiritual gifts serve a purpose, but if you turn them inward, if you misuse them, you miss the whole point of them. He starts by just simply going through the spiritual gifts. He says, if I speak in the tongues of men or of angels and do not have love, I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. I love the way Eugene Peterson describes this in The Message. He says, if I speak with human eloquence and angelic ecstasy but don't love, I'm nothing but the creaking of a rusty gate. Boy, I love that imagery. You've gone to a house, no one's gone through the gate in years. You start to go through the gate. You're like, I didn't like that sound. God doesn't like our sound if it's missing something. He goes in verse 2 and he talks about four of the spiritual gifts. Notice what he says. And by the way, here's the question. Why is he raising these issues? We'll come back to it here in a moment. Here's the second one. If I have the gift of prophecy, if I can fathom all mysteries, in other words, if I have the gift of discernment, if I have this special knowledge, because at this time there was no Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. How did Christians know about the life of Jesus? It was given to them by direct knowledge from the Holy Spirit. And he says, even if I have all of that knowledge, if I have faith, I mean, the church was just in its infancy. There needed to be people with this strong degree of faith, and that was a gift to some of them, so that I can even move mountains. But if I don't have love, nothing. And he says, and again, you have to ask why. And so he says, and if I give all I possess to the poor, give over my body to hardship that I may boast. It's fascinating, the meaning of that phrase, if I give my body to hardship. Here's the way the Passion Translation puts it. If I were to be so generous as to give away everything I own to feed the poor and to offer my body to be burned as a martyr without the pure motive of love, I'm nothing. Now, what's he doing here? Why does he keep bringing up illustration after illustration after illustration? Starting in verse 4, he tells us why.
Wait a minute. That's a phrase that probably should exist between verses 3 and 4. Now, where I'm from in West Virginia, we have what are called wait-a-minute vines. Maybe you're familiar with those. You're walking through the woods and all of a sudden one of them grabs you and says, wait a minute. It grabs your attention and holds you. So when you look at these verses, you start to see that all the way through these scriptures, we're finding that there is a competitiveness about these people in Corinth. And that competitiveness of the first century is not unique to the first century. Many of us, when we leave here today, we're going to go watch two football teams play football. Hopefully. If you like football, you know what I mean. Sometimes one team doesn't really seem to play, and the other one does. Competitiveness, though, is a part of our nature. It's a part of human nature. But sometimes that competitiveness gets in the way of us being the way God would intend or has intended for us to be. And that is part of why we see these verses starting with verse 4. Starting to challenge the way the people of Corinth and us today view these gifts. Sometimes we want that which brings us esteem. We will seek after that which builds us up. And therefore, when the Corinthians saw these special gifts, they thought, I want the one that gives me the most status. And that too is our nature. That is our uniqueness and our humanity, to seek after that which builds us up. And oftentimes when we do that, it is part of understanding how we as individuals are made, that within our nature there is a sense in which we desire that which elevates ourselves above God. And that's exactly what was happening in the first century. And the struggle for us today is to recognize that the gifts that God has given us should not be what we focus on. But rather recognize that if I put anything above this love that God has shown to us and demonstrated to us and called us to, then everything else that we do is of no value. How many things do we negate because we do not do them first out of love? A second aspect of understanding this, wait a minute before you get too excited about these gifts that you have, A second part of that is recognizing that so oftentimes it is us individually in how our relationships are formed that is the problem. You see, if I look at these verses in terms of relationship, I begin to recognize that God is more concerned with how I treat others than he is about the specific thing that I'm doing. We might call it actually getting the cart before the horse. That's the way it sounds right, doesn't it? But actually, we're trying to get the horse before the cart. That's the way it really works, though it's hard to say it that way. We're trying to get the horse in the place it belongs. We need to understand that being loving is to precede all of the things that we do. So how do we know? I suspect if we were to ask all of you today whether or not you believe you're loving, and don't raise your hand, but do you think that you are loving? Are you a loving person? I doubt there are many of us here that would say we're not. Now, there might be people that would say you aren't, but you individually would probably say, I think I'm loving. I think the way I treat others is loving. Well, one of the great things about these verses is God not only talks about love in the forms where we understand the emotional part of that, but he lists those things here as the behaviors of love. Therefore, we can actually evaluate whether or not we're being loving by looking at the nature and character of God as he describes the characteristics of love. So, are you patient? As a person, as you seek to do God's will, as you live your life for Christ, are you a patient person? Are you kind? Are you patient and kind as you deal with others? When you're at school, when you're at work, when you're at home, when you're driving down Gallatin Road, are you patient? Are you kind? See, there's more to it, though. If I could just stop there, we all might say, most of the time. The unique thing is, it would be hard for any of us to say we do these things perfectly all the time. Because whether or not we're in any one of those environments that I described, we are called to put our humanity aside and to elevate the way in which we behave to a level in which God has given us an ideal to pursue. So I look at these verses and I say, love is patient, love is kind. It does not envy. Somehow I develop a life in which I can see what you have and I don't feel like I have to have it. Think of the things in life that are that way. The things that we see around us. The way in which we view the things that other people have. Or the things that are available. Do I live in such a way as to suggest that I must have something someone else has? I'm envious. Do I boast? Do I build my own ego by boasting about the things that I have and that I do? It's interesting to be around someone that does that. Because if they do it on a regular basis, you know it's coming. And it's interesting to watch that. Conversation, conversation, conversation. Now let me tell you about me. Do you know folks like that? Yeah, don't mention them by name. But we do have some folks like that, right? There are those things within our human nature that we just seem to struggle with. And as we do that, it separates us from the character and nature of God. It is not proud. It is not rude. Oh boy. Oh, the ways we are rude to one another. Our nature so often comes out. If you're rude to me, guess what's coming back? The same amount of rude? What do you think? If you're rude to me, am I likely to respond with the same amount of rude? No, I'm going to up my game. You get more rude back, and back and forth it can go. Years and years ago, a guy by the name of Willard Harley wrote a book, and the name of the book was His Needs, Her Needs. And in that book, he talked about various things that both men and women need in relationships. And he did research with lots and lots of couples. And after all that research, he said, this should take care of it. This should be what we need for couples to do well, and couples still divorced. And he continued his research, and he wrote another book after that. The book he wrote after that was called Love Busters. And the idea was, you can do all the right things in marriage, but if there's about five things, if you do them, you destroy all of the good that you've done. It's the same premise that we see here in 1 Corinthians. You can do lots of good things, but if you do these things, you destroy the very work in which you're trying to honor God with. Finally, the thing that really has an effect when we fail to recognize how God would have us to love one another is it fails to connect us as one. The imagery there is Christ and the church. That oneness is created through love. That through a loving relationship there is one. Jesus says, be one as I and the Father are one. He says, greater love hath no man than that he would give his life for his friend. He elevates love to the highest level and says, our relationship, our oneness, our connection to God first and our connection to one another is dependent upon us understanding that we must elevate love in our life above everything else. That's why.
If you leave with nothing else this morning, I hope you'll remember this simple, I put it in the form of a math equation. But I think this is what Paul was trying to get across to us. And that is that spiritual gifts minus spiritual character. Spiritual gifts minus spiritual character equals nothing. As Brian was just talking, the very fact that they were envying these spiritual gifts that different ones had showed that their heart wasn't where it needed to be. And so Paul goes on in chapter 13 to explain why it was so important that you get the horse first in the horse and cart story. He says, listen, but where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. Here's what he's saying. These special gifts, they're not going to last. They're here for a brief moment of time to get the church up and running. Notice what he says, for we know in part, and we prophesy in part, but when completeness comes. That word completeness is a huge word. It's debated constantly among Bible scholars, because Paul says when that completeness comes, that which is in part will be done away with. That word is the Greek word teleos. And it carries with it a lot of meanings. It can mean finished, complete, perfect, mature. The King James Version translated it perfect. But when that which is perfect is come. I wish they had not done that. Because to know the meaning of a word, simply look at how it's used in the context. In this context, look at the very next verse. It tells you of these four words what he's talking about. When I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put the ways of childhood behind me. Again, my 2.5-year-old grandson Luke, the way he talks is, ride in Pop's truck. And of course, when you spend enough time with them, you respond, yes, ride in Pop's truck. You know, I mean, you talk like they do. And here is Paul saying, listen, we've got to be mature. We've got to grow up because God has a plan for the church. You turn over to Ephesians chapter 4, and he goes into these same gifts. In this case, they're gifts like apostles and prophets and evangelists, pastors and teachers. And he goes into why all of these gifts are given. And if you'll notice the underlined one, I'm pointing over to the left side here. The word here, he says, until we all reach unity in the faith and in the knowledge of the Son of God and become mature. Guess what word that word mature there is? Teleos. Same word he uses over in 1 Corinthians 13. And what Paul is trying to get across is that, listen, right now, yes. Right now, we're in a period of confusion because God's revelation hasn't all been given. The church hasn't been firmly established. There's a lot of give and take going on. For now, we see only a reflection as in a mirror. He's talking about ancient mirrors. This is an ancient mirror. Ancient mirrors didn't have glass. They were simply metals that would be polished enough that you could kind of see your reflection in them. And I got to be honest with you, I would have looked good in ancient mirrors. I mean, just enough to go, yeah, I think I'm all right. Paul's point that he's making is that, listen, right now we can't see clearly. Why? Because the church was just getting started. But he says, eventually, these other things will disappear. But three things will remain. Now notice the contrast there. These gifts will disappear. These three things will remain. Faith, hope, and love. The great triad of the Christian faith. And the greatest is love. Why? Because it is the one characteristic that most reflects the God that we serve. Put as simple as could be, John says in 1 John chapter 1 verse, excuse me, chapter 4 verse 8, God is love. I don't know where you are in your life, but God is calling you to a life of love. I mean, it's a life that centers on who He is and radiates that toward others because of it. If you're not a child of God, what are you waiting for? Experience the love that we all long for. Experience the love that we were created to experience by coming and becoming a child of God through faith and baptism. And if you're a child of God, but you've struggled because love has not been evident in your life, and therefore it's not been poured back into your life by others. We're here to pray with you, to encourage you, to lift you up, to build you up, because we love God. If we can help you, why don't you come right now as together we stand and sing.